It's Morning Edition from NPR News. Good morning. I'm Steve Inskeep, and we're joined this morning by the chief executive of BP. That's the company leasing the well that is now leaking thousands of barrels of oil each day into the Gulf of Mexico. The CEO is Anthony Hayward. He's on the line from Louisiana. Welcome to the program, sir.
Good morning, Steve. Thank you for the opportunity to talk with you.
Indeed, and thanks for taking our questions. I want to begin by playing you a statement by President Obama, who spoke over the weekend about your company.
Let me be clear. BP is responsible for this leak. BP will be paying the bill.
That's President Obama yesterday. Mr. Hayward, do you agree with those two statements? First, that BP is responsible, and second, that BP will pay the bill?
We are clearly mounting a massive response to what's been a tragic accident. We are working cooperatively with the federal authorities, the Coast Guard, and the local communities. And it is indeed BP's responsibility to deal with this, and we're dealing with it.
And are you going to pay the bill as well? That's the other part of the president's statement.
We will absolutely be paying for the cleanup operation. There is no doubt about that. That's our responsibility. We accept it fully.
Meaning even damage that is caused along the coastline, damages to people's livelihoods, you will take responsibility for that.
We have made it clear that where legitimate claims are made, we will be good for them.
One reason I ask about this specifically is because your company reportedly spent time in recent days trying to get Alabama residents to give up their right to sue in exchange for $5,000. Did you do that?
No, that was an early misstep in the process. It was a standard contract that the team were using. That was eliminated very early in the process. We now have a very large number of local people fighting this effort. We have over 700 fishing vessels deployed in support of this. In the last 48 hours, we've trained more than 3,000 people signed up onto the volunteer program. So there is an enormous effort to work with the local communities. And, you know, I would say I spent all of yesterday visiting with the local communities. I talked with a fisherman who was on the program. He was loading his vessel with oil booms to go and deploy them. I talked with National Guards. I talked with people from the community who just wanted to help. And we've said that anyone who turns up, we will employ and we'll deploy them in the effort.
And just to be totally clear on this question of responsibility, you're saying you are taking responsibility and you are going to pay a legitimate claims. Because you say legitimate claims, which is a fair enough qualifier, I'm reminded of the Exxon Valdez spill in Alaska more than two decades ago. As you know, Exxon tied up that case in court for about 20 years. Should we expect BP to do the same?
I'm very clear that we'll pay legitimate claims. We have a claims process set up. For small claims today, they're being paid instantly. Longer claims, we clearly have a bigger claims. We clearly have a process to run through. But in the case of all legitimate claims, we will be good for it.
We're talking with Anthony Hayward. He is the CEO of BP, which is dealing with a massive oil leak in the Gulf of Mexico. And let me ask you the question that I'm sure you've been asking your technical experts for days, Mr. Hayward. How are you going to stop this leak?
We have three ongoing activities. The first is to continue to work on the blowout preventer. This is like performing open-heart surgery at 5,000 feet.
Let's remember, there's a blowout preventer. It was a giant stack of machinery.
This is the equipment on the wellhead, which is the fail-safe mechanism, which, you know,
which failed.
Has failed. It's unprecedented for it to fail. It is the ultimate safety equipment on a drilling rig. No one understands why it's failed, but we have assembled in Houston 160 companies from across the industry to focus on this task. We have eight automatic submersible submarines deployed. And they're working around the clock to try and get that to operate.
The next thing is to try to replace it, I suppose.
Be successful. So the second intervention is that we have fabricated and will have on location by next weekend a subsea containment system, which the intention of containing the the leak in the subsea and bringing it to surface.
What does that mean, containment system?
It's like a dome or perhaps the hood on an oven that sits over the top of the leak and channels the oil to surface where we can treat it and deal with it.
Now, you said you have fabricated. There had been reports that you needed days more to get that built. You're saying you have one ready to go.
It's fabricated and will be on location next weekend.
Next weekend.
And, it's never been done in 5,000 feet of water. This is another, another technology challenge, but it's one that we were pursuing aggressively. The third intervention is to drill a relief well, which started operations yesterday. That well is now underway. And so that's the third intervention in the subsea.
Let's just clarify that for people. A relief well would basically get the oil up in a safe way and relieve some of the pressure that's blowing oil out of the well now.
It will intersect the existing well, and we will use it to control this well, isolate the well, and bring the situation under control.
There had been talk of trying to swap out this giant blowout preventer, take it away and replace it with one that functions. You didn't mention that option. Have you ruled that out?
It's one of the things that we continue to look at, but we need to ensure that we don't make a bad situation much worse. So the blowout preventer on the seabed today has mechanical integrity, and we want to ensure that as we intervene, that we don't make the situation worse.
Mr. Hayward, when BP was applying to drill this well, you told the U.S. government that an accident was very unlikely and that the well was so far from shore there'd be no significant adverse impact. That's a quote. But did you make the right judgment when pushing for the well in that way?
I think this is an unprecedented accident in terms of the failure of the blowout preventer. It is the ultimate safety system on any rig, and there is no precedent for them failing. To get to this point, you've had to breach multiple safety systems and then have the ultimate device fail. So there is no precedent for failure. What we are implementing is the response plan, and thus far it has been successful in containment, and we are very focused on ensuring that remains the case until such time as we can control the leak.
And one other quick question, given that this is, as you say, an unprecedented situation, it's causing people to rethink offshore oil drilling, and Florida Senator Bill Nelson is asking the U.S. to shut down all exploratory offshore wells in the U.S. until they've been inspected. Not a moratorium on new ones, shutting down existing wells. Given that things are happening that you never expected, do you agree with that proposal?
I think we clearly need to understand what has happened here. That will come out with the investigation.
But do you favor a moratorium on drilling for the moment?
We are working with the relevant authorities to determine what is the appropriate intervention to take based on what we have today.
Okay. Mr. Hayward, thanks very much for taking the time this morning.
Thank you very much.
Anthony Hayward is Chief Executive Officer of BP, which is operating the well that's now leaking thousands of barrels of oil per day into the Gulf of Mexico. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. Good morning. I'm Steve Inskeep. President Obama's visit to the Gulf Coast over the weekend reminds us that this is a political situation as well as an environmental disaster. The administration is facing some criticism for not moving quickly enough to respond to an oil spill in the Gulf. Joining us now, as she does most Mondays, is NPR's Cokie Roberts. Cokie, good morning.
Good morning, Steve.
Some people are asking if this disaster is President Obama's equivalent of Hurricane Katrina. Is that a fair comparison?
Well, the White House has rejected that comparison, but in saying that one was a devastating natural disaster where hundreds of people were killed, this other is an environmental hazard. But look, it's in the Gulf region, so that invites comparisons. And the way each of them unfolded, with the news getting worse and worse over the course of days, also makes you think of the Katrina disaster. The administration says, look, this is BP oil's problem, but also they want to show that there is a government response, which is, of course, why the president went yesterday. It is interesting to me, Steve, that some of the people who are calling for that response, including Louisiana's Republican governor and one of the senators, are the same people who have been saying the federal government does too much these days. So, you know, it all depends on where you're sitting.
Also got a dilemma, I suppose, because the people who've been saying drill, baby, drill, the president's critics, are now the people who would be criticizing him for the response to this.
Well, that's right. In fact, for this to come right after the president had talked about drilling, opening more offshore drilling is a problem for him politically. And one thing we do know is that public opinion, which has been strongly in favor of drilling, we historically have seen shifts away from that after an oil spill. But, you know, the president is now trying. He had his Secretary of Interior, Homeland Security, Thad Allen from the Coast Guard out assuring everyone yesterday that the government is doing everything, the Department of Defense, Interior, Environmental Protection, NOAA, along with the Coast Guard, 1,900 federal workers out there. So they are really trying to get out the story.
What does this spill mean for this region to which you have very close ties?
It's actually heartbreaking, Steve. Today is the inauguration of the new mayor in New Orleans, Mitch Landrieu. And, excuse me, that's been designed as a celebration of the city coming together, blacks and whites, an interfaith ceremony at St. Louis Cathedral. But now you've got this looming question of how is this going to affect the economy, and which is coming back after Katrina. It's already affected the fishing. 60% of the fisher people had returned after Katrina, but now it's already stopped. And some analyses of the possible economic impact are absolutely devastating. That's the reason, by the way, that this government study of the accident is so important, because we did learn after Katrina the fact that the levees failed was a man-made cause, and people have been able to collect money as a result of that. So studying the cause of this accident would be terribly important to the people of the region.
Do people along the Gulf Coast have a bit of a love-hate relationship with the energy industry?
Well, sure, because a lot of people work in the energy industry and need it to survive and have good pay and good lives. But then when you have something like this, you've got the tremendous danger to the fisheries, to the beaches, and some analyses say to the whole country that if the spill gets into the Gulf Stream, that the whole country can be affected.
So will the oil industry become the new bad guys, replacing perhaps the finance industry?
Well, I think oil and energy as a whole. Don't forget the mine disasters that we've just had in West Virginia and two people killed in a Kentucky mine. I think that you could be starting to see the energy industry as the new bad guy, particularly as the oil companies are making record profits. And the administration is stressing their responsibility. Secretary Salazar said yesterday that we have to keep the boot on the neck of British Petroleum. It could have an impact on the energy bill that has been languishing in the Senate, Steve. So, you know, the effect of all of this is really going to be a long time assessing.
Okay, thanks very much. Always a pleasure to hear from NPR's Cokie Roberts.
The title World's Largest Airline might soon be changing hands. United and Continental announced today that they've agreed to merge, and if approved by shareholders and regulators, the new combined airline would surpass Delta as the world's largest in terms of numbers of passengers carried. It's a $3 billion-plus deal, with United buying Continental. The new effort would keep the United name and Continental's logo with a swirling globe. NPR's David Shaper reports.
It's been a rough ride for commercial airlines in recent years. First, skyrocketing fuel costs cut into revenues. Then losses were compounded by the global economic crisis and recession. The five big legacy airlines, American, Continental, Delta, United, and U.S. Airways, have lost a combined $29 billion over the last 5 years. So it is within that context that Continental and United see merging operations as the best way to strengthen themselves. Continental CEO Jeff Smizek.
We are creating an airline here today that has a far brighter future than either of us individually could have ever created on our own.
If the merger is approved by shareholders and federal regulators, Smizek would run the new United Airlines, and he says it will be a good deal for all concerned.
This merger benefits all our stakeholders. Our customers, we're providing an unparalleled global network on a single carrier.
United in particular has been looking for a merger partner for some time, as it's had a particularly bad decade. The huge slump in air travel following the September 11th terrorist attacks accelerated United's fall into bankruptcy in 2002, and it didn't emerge from Chapter 11 protection until 2006. In fact, United reached a tentative agreement to merge with Continental 2 years ago, but Continental backed out because United was in much weaker financial shape then. United has used the last 2 years to trim capacity and other costs to make it a stronger partner while flirting with other possible merger mates, including U.S. Airways. But at the airline's merger announcement in New York today, United CEO Glenn Tilton said Continental is the one that fits in with United best.
This is not a defensive combination of companies. This is a combination of companies that creates future opportunity. So it creates future value for shareholders. It creates future opportunity for employees, and it creates an enormous opportunity for customers that they didn't previously have.
For international travelers, that appears to be true. Industry analysts say Continental is strong in Central and South America, while United's strengths are to Europe and the Pacific. Vicky Bryan of the New York-based corporate research firm Gimme Credit is one of many financial analysts applauding the merger.
This is a situation where you have two very complementary market profiles. They have very little overlap in the same markets. They have no overlap overseas.
Airline officials say they don't plan to eliminate a lot of jobs because of the merger, though some redundant positions will be cut from both Continental's headquarters in Houston and United's home offices in Chicago, where the combined airline will reside. The employee unions for the two airlines, while not rushing to embrace the deal, suggest they may be able to support it, with the exception of United's flight attendants, who say they need a new contract before any merger can go through. So what can airline passengers expect?
Higher prices is certainly the most likely result. I mean, I think it's inevitable.
Aaron Gelman, professor of management and transportation at Northwestern University, says the continued consolidation of U.S. airlines into bigger and bigger behemoths should certainly give federal antitrust regulators reason to thoroughly review, if not question, the United Continental merger. The Justice Department says it plans to do just that. Officials for the airlines say they hope to have the deal finalized by the end of the year. David Shaper, NPR News.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. Online games connected to social networking sites like Facebook are going viral. Games like Farmville, a game in which you cultivate an online farm. Farmville went from 10 million users when it was introduced last August to now more than 80 million. And it's not your typical 30-year-old male behind the computer screen. Reporter Kaomi Getz has the story.
Carrie Ann King is 41, a mother of four, and a part-time fitness instructor. She unwinds during a rare break between work and family responsibilities inside her Manhattan apartment. Reading or watching TV? No. She's playing an online game called Bejeweled.
And the goal is to get rows of a minimum of three, a maximum of five together. And that's how you get points.
Kind of like Tetris, Bejeweled is a puzzle game of blinking jewels arranged in a grid. The game is found on the social networking site Facebook, which already links players to their friends. King can play against her friends' scores. She says there's a lot of trash talk going on.
The people who play are serious, like really my competition are all people that I either went to high school or college with. My mom plays, but sorry, Mom, you're not in the same league.
Even moms like TV's Kelly Ripa are getting in on it. She recently admitted her obsession to Jerry Seinfeld on her daytime TV show.
You had a video game that you got hooked on?
It was called, what's it called?
Blocker?
It's not Brick Breaker. It's called Jewels, Bejeweled, Bedazzled. Yes, you know the game. Ladies, put your hands together for Bejeweled.
We've still barely sort of hit the tip of the iceberg for people who could play games but don't think they can. With Bejeweled, 70% of our customers are women. And that astounds almost everybody.
That's David Roberts, CEO of game company PopGap. It created Bejeweled and other online games. Though not new, the game is discovering a whole new market by finding players where they are now, on mobile phones, iPods, and on Facebook. The games are free, but its creators make money off of advertising and added features. 100 million sessions of Bejeweled are played each day.
Even on a place like Facebook, where everybody thought, including us, thought, okay, it'll skew younger, it'll skew more male because it's competitive, it's a one-minute game, it's not our traditional audience, we were wrong.
Meshach Piskorski teaches about online social networking at the Harvard Business School.
What you find is that a lot of women who are both working and raising children just have no time for relationships. But it's not like they wouldn't want to spend more time having these relationships. It's just really, really hard. And this allows them to sustain these relationships.
Piskorski says the games aren't taking away from face-to-face interactions. They're just replacing time these women would have spent watching TV or some other media. And for busy Carrie Ann King, that's good enough, especially in New York City.
For the most part, you don't just wander over to someone's house, knock on their back door, and say, do you want to have lunch? So this is the back door.
And you don't have to borrow sugar. For NPR News, I'm Kayomi Getz in New York.
For more stories about gaming, social media, and tech gadgets, check out the All Tech Considered blog. That's npr.org/alltech. This is NPR. This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Michelle Norris. The 2010 baseball season has begun, and our book reviewer, Alan Chews, has found what he considers the first fine baseball novel of the season. It's called The Man with Two Arms, and it's written by Chicago writer and teacher Billy Lombardo.
The man of the title is Danny Granville. He comes from Chicagoland, and he has two golden arms. His baseball-crazed father, Henry, raises him from infancy to play ball, and specifically to pitch both left-handed and right-handed. With coach's thoughts in his head and AstroTurf in his basement, Father Henry cultivates a champion, a switch pitcher who grows up to become a beautifully trained athlete with a great talent for baseball. Through high school and college, we watch Denny grow, and when he hits the majors, playing for the Cubs, his first season looks as though it's going to be a triumph. Denny is something like a natural, and his game-obsessed father does everything he can to enhance his son's natural abilities. From the boy's first year on, the father directs him steadily and scientifically toward balance. As Denny's art student girlfriend Bridget discovers when she gets him to undress in preparation for posing for her, that early propensity for balance has produced in the ballplayer an anatomical symmetry close to perfection. It seems perfectly appropriate that Denny begins his major league career by pitching several games as close to perfect as it gets when the pitcher bows out in a late inning. Lombardo's one-of-a-kind novel about a one-of-a-kind ball player is just as engrossing as a perfect game going into the late innings. If you're in the stands, you don't want to look away from the field, let alone leave the stadium early. Those who love to read about this great pastime will have the same feeling when reading about Denny Granville on and off the field.
The novel is The Man with Two Arms by Billy Lombardo. Our reviewer, Alan Chews, teaches writing at George Mason University in Fairfax, Virginia.
And now another view of life in New Orleans. Some of you may have been glued to your television sets last night for the latest installment in the critically acclaimed series Tremé. The HBO drama has already garnered critical acclaim and counts President Barack Obama among its fans. In Tremé, the characters are as big as the music they love, and everybody is trying to navigate life in a post-Katrina New Orleans. The series begins 3 months after the hurricane, when many in New Orleans began to greet each other in a new way.
Hey, how's your house?
Oh, no.
How's your house?
We're up on Octavia. What about you?
Still living on the boat.
Y'all got a lot of water?
You see the line over my head?
You can't stay here, Dad.
Wait. Yeah.
Yes. I'm this close to getting a new water heater. Do you think you could float me along?
Oh.
I'm a musician. What do you want me to say?
You're a disc jockey.
Few know these corners of New Orleans as well as Lola's Eric Eli. He's a writer for Treme, a former columnist for the Times-Picayune, and also co-producer of a documentary on the New Orleans neighborhood from which Treme takes his name. And he's joining us now from his home office in New Orleans to give us an update on how things are going. Welcome to you. How are you doing?
I'm doing well, Michelle. Thanks for asking.
Well, can I just get your sense of things in the wake of this? Well, Bob Marshall just told us it's not a spill. It's a river of oil. Can I just ask how you're reacting to all this?
It's a shock in that so much is going well this year. I mean, between the Saints and the announcement of the show, and it's doing well. The impression was that we might have been leaving our worst fears behind. But this brings to mind many of the disaster worst-case scenarios that we feared after the federal levee failure.
Is it bringing up some bad memories for you?
Yeah.
And not just you, I assume.
Well, at the time when Hurricane Katrina hit, I was a columnist for the Times-Picayune, and one of the things I wrote about was the impact on fisheries. And there's a lot about the federal policy that made it difficult to get aid to fishermen. And that is not only our livelihood financially, it's also our culture.
I want to mention that today is a big day in the life of New Orleans, nearly 5 years after Katrina struck the coast. Today is also the last day that New Orleans Mayor Ray Nagin serves. A new mayor is taking over. How is all that playing together? You've got, on the one hand, new leadership coming in who was elected with wide-ranging support. And I don't know, how is all that working together?
Well, Mitch Landrieu's election as mayor is another part of the optimism here, the sense that we can turn a new page in the book. And so it's just a great juxtaposition to have those two different elements happening simultaneously. The last couple of years of the Nagin administration have been particularly troubling in that it seemed to many people that the mayor had been beaten down by all that he'd gone through and was neither particularly effective nor particularly interested in the job. So Mitch Landrieu brings a new energy to the office, but this reminds us, this oil spill reminds us that some of the old problems still remain.
So let's talk a bit about Treme. Why did you want to be involved in this, in the series, and how did you come to be involved in it?
Well, I had met David Simon during the last season of The Wire because my high school classmate, Wendell Pierce, lived next door. At that point, we threw a joint carnival party, so all the guys from The Wire were down here. We met then, and he called me a couple of times subsequent to that. And although I had not initially thought about going into television writing, the opportunity to tell our story to the HBO audience, and perhaps more importantly, to humanize these issues that everyone in America has heard about, but relatively few of us have any real sense of, that was a great opportunity. And most of the time what you hear from the politicians and from the Chamber of Commerce is about all the economic stuff. You should come down here and build your plant and so forth. But that's not really what we're good at. And these people are interested in what we're good at and who we are.
You know, the series doesn't pull any punches about some of the things that, how can we put this, that many people find kind of crazy making about New Orleans. Like there's a line in last night's episode, an exchange where the character of Sonny, the musician, tells somebody a line to the effect of, I traveled all the way from Amsterdam to New Orleans and you couldn't drive 5 hours.
A lot of what Sonny is talking about is the fascination that the world has with New Orleans. But part of what's been problematic for us is the things that New Orleans is so great at. We're talking about food, music, architecture, culture, a sense of a regional culture, even in the midst of all this American culture. Those things are not really valued nationally. Most people around the country wonder whether or not they're going to get a new Walmart or a new McDonald's. We're more worried about whether or not the old traditions of po' boys and of our local grocery stores, et cetera, will remain.
Do you feel that the series is in part a way to help the country understand what it is that they should value and love as much as you do?
It really is, because part of what was problematic about getting our story out immediately after Hurricane Katrina was the politics of it were so complicated. Because George Bush took so long to get here initially, any criticism of government reaction was really going to be focused on him. But in fact, our main problem was not his fault. Our main problem was the failure of the Army Corps of Engineers over several decades to build decent levees. And neither George Bush nor Barack Obama now seems to really understand the magnitude of that crisis. Everyone talks about what Hurricane Katrina did to New Orleans. Hurricane Katrina did not do that much to New Orleans. It did tremendous damage to the Gulf Coast of Mississippi. What Hurricane Katrina did was overtop and breach levees that were supposed to be able to withstand it. That's what John Goodman's rant about is in the first episode. It's like, wait a minute, this is what actually happened here. And more important, when you look at flooding in other places, now we're talking about flooding in Tennessee today, these are also Army Corps of Engineer projects that need to be examined, need to be subject to further scrutiny. That's the lesson of New Orleans.
Well, it obviously, one doesn't want to overstate the impact that any one television show, book, series, whatever, can have on that kind of ingrained point of view. But having said that, do you have any sense of how you will know if your point of view and the point of view of others who are shared there is getting headway, or whether people are starting to see it the way you see it?
Well, I tell you, we have messages that we would like to convey, but fundamentally, this has to be good television and good storytelling. And if people enjoy the show on whatever level they enjoy it, we'll be happy and we'll feel ourselves to be successful. There was a public school here that had been a predominantly black public school that now is a charter school and predominantly white. We got a brief line about that situation in one of our episodes. A lot of local people caught it. The national audience probably didn't and shouldn't have. It was not something that they needed to understand. But in that sense, if the national audience can enjoy the show and be interested in what happens to our characters, we'll be successful.
Finally, just want to read a line from David Simon, as you mentioned, one of the co-creators of Treme, wrote an open letter to the people of New Orleans that appeared in the Times-Picayune, where he talked about kind of the balance between good drama and being sort of journalistically accurate. And he wrote, "Your sensibilities matter to us because we have tried to be honest with that extraordinary time, not journalistically true, but thematically so. We have depicted certain things that happened and others that didn't happen, and then still others that didn't happen, but truly should have happened. This is a nice way of saying we have lied." I'm sorry, I just wanted to read that because I thought it was funny. So, any final thought for us? And good luck to you with all that's going on down there.
Well, I appreciate you calling. John Logsdon and I did a documentary about this neighborhood called Faubourg Treme, which is a big part of my education in the neighborhood and understanding its importance to the country. So that was really a big part of my understanding. And I'm happy that we're now getting the kind of attention that we deserve for this part of the country.
All right. Lois Eric Eli is a writer for the HBO series Treme. He's also co-producer and co-director, as he just told you, of the documentary Faubourg Treme, The Untold Story of Black New Orleans. And he joined us from his home office in Treme. And I thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you, Michelle.